Good morning, DJ and PK. It's 97.5 and 1280 The Zone. Well, the Utah Jazz do it again, 10 in a row. I thought that was, I don't want to say it was easy or it was effortless, but man, they were in control the whole way. And it really wasn't over until the last couple minutes. But from the first quarter, when they finished the quarter on a 5-0 run, to the second quarter, they finished on a 14-2 run. Thought that was a pretty good first quarter. Halftime, I thought they're in great shape because usually play better in the second half than they do in the first. We've seen them put away a bunch of games of good third quarters. So if you give them a healthy lead going into halftime, the Jazz are in great shape, and they were. They get the win. We'll get to the best of the postgame show coming up. But a few big picture storylines, they're going to follow the Jazz over the next month or two. PK and I talking about them with Ben Anderson. You hear him on the pre-half and postgame radio broadcast. Here are PK and I with Ben. Ben, good morning.
Good morning, guys.
So I'm listening to you and Jake doing your Sunday show after the game. I want you to know people are listening. I was one of them.
And, well, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that I want to write about, and I want you to just do my homework for me so I don't have to do it and take the easy way out because that's what I do now. You were talking about scoring and how the Jazz just didn't have enough scoring in the past, and you're speaking about Bogdanovich and his 30-point games. Could you explain that to this audience as far as, you know, what they had, particularly last year, beyond Mitchell, and what they have this year beyond Mitchell, and how much better it is?
Yeah, I know Quinn Snyder hates that we like to count things in tens. He just thinks it's kind of a superfluous number, where whether you have a 20-point-per-game score or 30-point-per-game score, it is a little bit arbitrary. I understand that. But you look at the Jazz last year, and they had three players who scored 30 points. Donovan Mitchell did it something like 17 times. Jay Crowder did it one time. Grayson Allen did it one time. And Grayson Allen did it in Game 40, and it took overtime to get there, and the starters didn't play. And now you've got a guy in Bojan Bogdanović who's done it, I believe, eight times now, and the Jazz are 7-1 in that stretch. So it's just nice when you're a basketball team, when your best player can have an off night or truly an off night and not even play in Donovan Mitchell, and you've got a guy in Bojan Bogdanović who's a proven scorer who can step in and give you that. And then now for the fourth time this season, and it's only happened four times, I want to say all four have happened since Christmas. I know, in fact, all of them have, because the first one was Jordan Clarkson. You've got a player coming off the bench who's giving you 20. Now, Jordan Clarkson's done it three times for the Jazz, and Emmanuel Mudiay has done it one time since then. And that's just how much better you're playing. And truthfully, in the modern NBA, as much as defense should travel and defense should be able to be there every game, some nights you're off. I mean, if you watch the Wizards game, I don't know if he was sick, but Royce O'Neal's defense was not what it had been. And obviously there is that cold that's going around the team, and I don't know if that's why he was sluggish. I don't know if it was just a bad matchup with Bradley Beal, but the Jazz were giving up points, and they needed to score, and they needed to score 127 points to win that game. And here's a remarkable stat. Now, I think the Jazz have scored 128 points three times this year. They've scored 127 points one time this year, and they've won all those games. But I think the Jazz are also winning games when they're giving up the most points on the defensive side of the ball, where they gave up 126 to the Pelicans, and they still won that game. That's just not a game they would win in the past, and sometimes you just have to be able to fight fire with fire.
That's 100% a game they would not have won in the past. And I don't know what's more impressive with Bogdanović, the raw, you know, total number of points he's scoring, or more to the point that I think Quinn would sign off on, is kind of the attitude, like, when you know the team needs points. Now, in this case, you know, because Donovan Mitchell literally isn't playing. But in another game, maybe, where things aren't going well and you know you need buckets, it seems like Bogdanović just has the skill first, the size and the skill, but saying it, the attitude, like, I better go get some buckets. We really need them right now. The first half, I thought, you know, in a variety of ways, too. Score from the free throw line, drive and score inside, hit the catch and shoot threes. He's got multiple ways to go, and if he gets trapped behind the basket, he'll fake the behind-the-back wraparound pass and then throw it the other way and get somebody an open three. There's so many options.
Yeah, he's truly a great offensive player, and it is a little bit bizarre, I guess, and maybe it's just because Donovan's been so good and because Rudy's so good that he's not getting any all-star love. And it's a forward who averages 20 points a game and shoots 40% from the three-point line. I mean, those guys are all-stars. And Bogdanovich is getting absolutely no love for that. So, I mean, that does speak to the level of how good the other players on this team are, and also how overlooked he is, and the fact that I don't think he really cares about those types of accolades. He doesn't seem like he's that type of guy. But, yeah, I mean, he's just been an unbelievable addition. And I think to your point, I want to say it was on the road at Memphis. I know the Jazz lost one of those games, but they had another one, and it must have been in the middle of that five-game road trip where they lost the two on each side. The Jazz were, what, down 15 or down 10 to Memphis in that game, and Boyan came out in the third quarter and just said, like, if no one's going to score, I'll just score. I'll just take this game over, and he did that. And having an ability to do that, especially from a guy who is such a mismatch because he shoots as well as he does and he's as big as he is, it's just, again, it's an advantage truly the Jazz probably haven't had since Karl Malone was on the team as far as a mismatch scorer like that.
So I think it comes down to how much is this built on a solid foundation, how much of this, speaking of the win streak, obviously, and how much of this is built on the fact that they're beating sub-500 teams. My line of thinking is this is the NBA, and we take Brooklyn as an example. Okay, they're not a great team, but on any given night, they're certainly not a bad team. This is not like college when you get some teams that the talent level is just so drastically different, like Gonzaga, say, in the West Coast Conference, and we see what they do the other night. They're up 40 at halftime against San Diego, I think it was. And in the NBA, it normally isn't like that, particularly on a given night, recognizing that the Jazz were down by 40 against Toronto. So how real is this winning streak and this great run they've been on?
And if all these games were against the Rockets and the Mavericks and the Nuggets and the Lakers. So, I mean, I think it's fair to say that, and I don't think anyone would disagree with me. And also on the streak, they've missed Drew Holiday. They missed Zion Williamson. They missed Blake Griffin. They missed Zach Collins. They've missed a lot of really good players who have been out for their teams. And certainly that plays into it. But, yeah, I mean, they all have 12 NBA players. I was listening to Joe Ingles on your show last week, and he's right. You know, every team is littered with NBA players. That's why they're in the league, and everyone can play. And the fact that the Jazz have avoided bad fluctuations where, I mean, even against the Wizards, if we're talking about the Jazz identity right now, it's defense and it's three-point shooting. And against the Wizards, they were 10 of 30 from the three-point line, so 33%, so far below average. And then their defense was bad, really bad in the first half, and they still won that game on the road. That's really hard to do, and that authenticates how well they're playing and proves how well they're playing, that they're finding ways to win games even when they're missing players like Donovan Mitchell. They are very clearly clicking. They very clearly have momentum, and maybe most importantly, they have a belief that they can win every game when they step on the floor, and I really believe that was not the case early in the season.
So we've established that they're going to win the vast majority, if not all of the games against teams that are 500 and below. But in the next month, and we are about a month away here from the All-Star break, and in the next month, they've got to play Indiana and Miami, who are pretty good from the East, and they got to play Denver, Dallas, and Houston home and home. So they have eight games against quality teams coming up here in the next month. I'm just curious, okay, you can beat everybody below 500, but do you win 30% of the games against teams that are pretty good playoff teams? Do you win 50? Do you win 70? I don't really have a good feel for that. Do you?
Yeah, so the Jazz right now are winning something absurd, like 88% of their games against teams below 500. Now, what's funny is in the NBA this year, there's 17 teams below 500, so that's going to give you a winning record if you do that alone. So they're in good shape there. And then the Jazz are actually, and not actually, obviously, they've always been this way, they're great at home. What, do they have three losses at home this season?
Second,
I mean, they're playing very well.
Second best record in the league at home.
Okay, so when they're doing that, they're beating good teams there as well. And if you're beating good teams at home and then beating up on the bad teams, you're going to have a good record. And then the Jazz now are, what, 12-9 on the road? So they've actually got a plus 500 record away from home, which is an enormous plus. So I honestly think the Jazz should expect to beat 50% of the really good teams in the NBA. They should be splitting series with the best of the best. And they've done that with Milwaukee. They did that with Philadelphia. They need to prove they can do it with Boston and Denver and the Lakers and the Clippers. And they beat the Clippers twice. So they split the series with the Clippers already as well. So I think that's reasonable. I think if you're winning 50% of those games, that's your goal. And if you're winning at home, I mean, that's why you want to have home court advantage. You're going to a seven-game series. You're not going to win them all 4-0. You're probably going to have to win 4-2 or 4-3. And that's the advantage of being able to split games and then being able to win the extra game when you're at home. And I think that's the formula to getting to at least the Western Conference Finals.
Are the Lakers uncatchable at this point in the West?
Probably during the regular season, yes.
Yeah.
Unless the Jazz continue to win at a 90% win rate, maybe they catch them. But I think currently that they're uncatchable. And it's only, what, four games right now? But I don't see, unless there's an injury, and obviously that dictates everything in the NBA, unless there's a major injury, I don't think the Jazz are going to be able to catch them because they should be able to beat up on bad teams too. In fact, the Lakers, I think, are undefeated. I think they're 20-0 or 21-0 against teams below 500. So that's the good thing. They are just not blowing bad games. And I know they were down at the half to the Cavaliers last night, and then they beat them by 30. So they really are steamrolling some teams.
I think the Jazz are getting two players to the All-Star game. How many do you think they're getting?
I know Donovan Mitchell's going to go. I just don't see how you leave a 24-point-per-game scorer out as much of a highlight as he is. And just looking at the guards in the West right now and the fact that the Jazz are going to be a top three or four seed most likely by the time the voting ends, the coaches have to put them in. It will be interesting to see the momentum that New Orleans has coming up over this break and then whether or not Karl Anthony Towns comes back. And maybe this Karl Anthony Towns injury, and apparently his return is imminent, but he's missed several games. He's only played something like 22 games this year. If he comes back, I mean, he's the number four or five leading scorer in the NBA. It's really hard for coaches to leave that guy out. The Timberwolves are awful, and the Pelicans are awful, but Brandon Ingram's also scoring 28 points a game, 27 points a game. So if both of those guys make it in, and they get in because they're such good scorers, Rudy Gobert doesn't make it.
What?
But if
no, Ben, take that back now.
If one of those guys doesn't make it, then I think Rudy Gobert has to be in, but he should have been in last year. I mean, it wasn't even close that he should have been over LaMarcus Aldridge last year, and he still didn't make it. So I think that's his pathway. It's going to be those three guys fighting for two spots.
If Gobert doesn't make it, I ain't getting a haircut until he makes it.
That's going to be a while. It's at least a year.
PK with a ponytail.
When I was a kid, I'd get my hair cut once a year. No big deal. Throwback Thursday.
Ben, there's a photo you've got to see. Yach, back me up on this. Does Ben have to see that photo?
Ben, I'll text it to you.
Okay, no, you can't text it to him. I need to see Ben's face when he sees that photo.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay?
It's just a sign of the times.
Yeah, I know, but it's classic. And I do think that irregardless, you should do that again, whether Gobert makes the All-Star game or not.
Gobert has got to make the All-Star game. If he doesn't make the team, I mean the team, not the game, but if he doesn't make the team this year, it's an absolute joke. It's the biggest I'll ball. Forget Gobert. I'll weep if he doesn't make it.
Dikembe Mutombo was a no-doubt Hall of Famer, and that's who Rudy Gobert is. And he's made three all-NBA defensive first teams. He's made two all-NBA teams. And unfortunately, we just don't look at those very often when we're talking about Hall of Fame voting. And he still needs his work to do. He's not a Hall of Famer if he retires today. But he's got two Defensive Player of the Year awards. He probably needs to make four All-Star games or three All-Star games, get three more All-NBA teams and three more All-Defensive teams. And if he does that, he's probably got a Hall of Fame career. But if you don't make these All-Star games, that's what people look at. And it's why Joe Johnson has a legit case to make the NBA Hall of Fame, because he's made it six times to the All-Star game. It just matters. It's how we go back and talk about players and who made an All-Star game this year and who didn't. And that means that, you know, John Stockton wasn't as good a player as Kevin Johnson, as some people want to argue, or Isaiah Thomas was better than X player. You have to make the All-Star game for your legacy. And Rudy Gobert has a legacy that's worth remembering, I think, for the NBA.
Mutombo, an eight-time All-Star. So
Mutombo was great, and Rudy Gobert is really great. I don't think there's any question Jazz fans recognize it. I do think Rudy has so much nuance to his game that they just look like missed layups if you've never watched him before, but then you realize every team misses layups that they don't miss against other teams, against the Jazz, that you probably have to watch him more than four times a year or two times a year when your team plays him to understand truly how great he is.
There's Ben Anderson. Hear him on the pre-half and post-game shows right here on the Zone Sports Network. When we come back, the best of the post-game show. Stay with us.
Take the Zone with you wherever you go.
Let's go.
Download the all-new Zone Sports Network app on your phone and get live streaming of the Zone as well as podcast editions of every show. From Salt Lake to Shanghai, Provo to Portugal, or Ogden to Oslo, wherever you go, we'll tag along.
Let's go.
Download the new Zone app by searching Zone Sports Network wherever you shop for apps. It's the Zone Sports Network app from 97.5 1280 The Zone and the Zone Sports Network.
Good morning, DJ and PK. It's 97.5 and 1280 The Zone. The Jazz do it again. Build up a pretty healthy lead with a good run right before halftime. They go on to beat the Nets. Here are the guys wrapping it all up.
Your Jazz recap here on 97.5 and 1280 The Zone. Jake Scott with you. The Jazz have now won 10 consecutive games and 14 out of their last 15. They beat the Nets last night, 118-107 in Brooklyn, behind a career-high tying 27 points from Joe Ingles, who was red hot, 10 of 14 shooting. He also had 4 assists and 3 rebounds. It is the 6th time that Joe Ingles has tied his career high with 27 points, which is just remarkable in and of itself. But the Jazz had a very, very nice game. This game wasn't even as close as the final score indicated. Rudy Gobert with a monster night, 22 points, 18 rebounds. He even had 4 assists, adding a couple of blocks. Of course, Donovan Mitchell struggled in the first half. It was lights out in the fourth quarter. He had 25 points, 4 assists. He also had a steal. Bogdanovich with 18 points and Jordan Clarkson with 13 points coming in off the bench. Offset a really nice night from Kyrie Irving, who had 32 points and 11 assists in 32 minutes. But most the rest of the Nets team struggled last night as the Jazz go on to a victory and actually shot 50% from the field. All right, let's take you through some postgame sound. Let's start with the walk-off interview with Rudy Gobert.
The second quarter was as dominant as any player on either side of the floor as I've seen this season. Could you feel that when it was happening?
Definitely. I mean, it was a team effort, but I could feel that, you know, they were completely out of what they were doing, and they were just scared to go to the basket. They weren't even looking at the basket, so it was a big stretch for us.
Are you? What does a 10-game win streak feel like for a player?
It feels like he doesn't want to stop. You know, you want to keep winning and keep winning. The more you win, the more you get used to winning, and he's got to keep going. You know, we got to keep getting better, and you know, it's fun. It's fun to be a part of a group that embraced that.
What are you figuring out with that crazy Australian on the pick and roll?
I mean, he's finally shooting the ball, so it's great. You know, I just got to set screens and let him do his work, his magic.
His magic. did Kyrie, does he take something different defensively than other players for you when he's coming at you?
I mean, he's so crafty, and he's always in attack mode. So, you know, you got to live with the tough shots and don't let him get layups or threes. And I think we did a great job tonight, not giving him anything easy at the rim. He made a lot of contested twos, and, you know, those are tough shots, and that's a shot that we're willing to give up.
Congratulations on a great night, Rudy, and truly that five-minute span in the second quarter, there's not been a player in the NBA on either end of the floor that's been that good. You were great.
Is that your tweet of the night?
That is my tweet of the night. I didn't at you, but if you want to go find it, it's out there.
I appreciate
it. I'll at you now.
That'd be great. Amy.
All right, see you.
All right.
That is Rudy Gobert.
That was Rudy Gobert with David Locke. Rudy was awesome, 22 points and 18 rebounds. Let's now let you hear from Jazz head coach Quinn Snyder.
You know, I think we're getting contributions from a lot of guys. You know, I thought Rudy was terrific. He just it was a dominant performance by him on both ends of the floor. You know, Joe obviously, you know, playing with Rudy and, you know, even him driving and making plays. I thought Emmanuel and Jordan, when they came in the game, gave us some big buckets. So, you know, you kind of go on. Donovan, especially late, when we really needed to score, they were scoring, and you know, we had to answer, and Donovan made a few really big moves to the rim and finished. So, you know, all the way down the line, and everybody's defending, you know. Not going to be perfect every possession, but guys are really committed to defending together.
When it became an 8-point game, what did you see in those moments collectively from your group to respond?
Well, I thought Brooklyn was playing well, and they were, you know, they were scoring, whether it's Dinwiddie or Kyrie. They came up with a couple loose balls, and, you know, I thought we answered offensively when we needed to, and, you know, you're not going to – sometimes you're just against a good team, you're not going to get every stop, and you know, you have to respond. And then I think we continued to defend and got some big ones when we needed.
I know you're not one for winning streaks, but what are you most proud of the play in these last 10 wins?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You snuck in these last 10 wins. You snuck in. Yeah. Our whole goal has been, you know, to try to get better. And I think we've been able to win in different ways. And different guys have stepped up and had, not, I wouldn't say even big games, but stretches in the game where, you know, the team needs something. I mentioned Jordan and Emmanuel. I think both those guys have done that during stretches. Sometimes one basket is more than 2 or 3 points. You know, they're momentum plays. So our guys are committed to defending together. It's an unselfish team. That's probably what I'm most proud of.
The way Joe's shooting the ball, is it just hot hand? Are you seeing him do things to create those
advantages? I think the catch and shoot threes, particularly in transition, you know, there's been times where we on the bench feel like he's open, and you know, we can't go out there and play for him. He's got guys flying at him, but at his height, I think he's been more focused, you know, on getting a shot and getting volume. And you know, when you do that, and you're a good shooter, it kind of takes your conscious mind out of it. Anyways, he doesn't need to think, and then he's being instinctive. He's shooting the ball off the dribble. And he's shooting it in transition. And he's just very confident. And I think part of that just comes from, you know, everybody on this team right now is getting confidence from one another. And Joe knows that guys want him to shoot and attack. And he's mixed it up. You know, he's gone to the rim and he's looking for other people. He's had big assist games as well. So I don't think he's just fixated on scoring. But when he has opportunities, obviously he's done it. And he's been aggressive.
Coach, the Nets are kind of trying to figure out ways to get their three playmakers in Kyrie and Spencer and Karis when they're on the floor together to kind of figure out ways to make that work. Now you have something similar with Donovan and Mike and Bojan. What was that process like for you trying to figure out ways to make them work together even on their own?
Mm-hmm. Obviously I can't speak for those guys. Are all, you know, terrific players and different, but all very, very talented and efficient and effective. I think for us, it's different every possession. You know, it's different every game. And I think it involves guys just really trusting each other and knowing that the ball is going to come back to you. And, you know, in our case, it's taken some time. It's not going to be, like I said, perfect every night. Sometimes it's more difficult to, you know, to move the ball so it can find people. So I think I think guys have to trust each other and be unselfish and make the right play. And, you know, playmaking is just that. You know, it can be creating for yourself and creating for teammates. I think our guys enjoy, you know, creating for their teammates as much as they do scoring.
There's Quinn Snyder after his team won their 10th consecutive game, 118-107 over the Brooklyn Nets. Let's wrap things up. Let you hear from Donovan Mitchell.
These last 10 games, what are you seeing out there?
We're in a groove. You know, I think a lot of the offense comes instinctively. Defensively, you know, I think it's the same. You know, a lot of times in the beginning of the year, we had to communicate a lot. Now it's kind of just like, you know, if we make a mistake, one person has each other's back, and you know, we're just flowing. You know, I don't think a lot of it's not called. A lot of it's just natural instinct of taking over.
Became an 8-point game there, and then coach was saying you answered. Mm-hmm. What was going on for you at that moment?
Me specifically? I had to give my team some. You know, I was struggling all game, you know, obviously a little under the weather, but, you know, I think my teammates just trusted me in those moments, you know, just taking the ball to the rim, being aggressive. I don't think I got into the paint for a layup until the second half, you know, so I think that changes a lot. So just being able to get to the rim and attack, and then when you see the few go in, that's when things get going.
Thank you. I saw you exchange jerseys with Kyrie just as a young guard in the league. Is there stuff you're going to take from his game?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot you could take. You know, for one thing, his mindset. You know, you look at how he took over the game in the fourth. You know, I try and implement that in my game as well. You know, no matter how the night's going, you know, try and, you know, be able to, and I say take over, not just score, but, like, find the right guys, make the right plays. He's a guy that, you know, is one of the best guards in the league. You know, I've grew up watching him, obviously, so it's pretty cool to be able to exchange jerseys with him. And, you know, for him, he's home. home, and you know it's nice for him. But just for me, just being able to watch on the court and watch from afar, he's a guy that you know understands the moment, understands the game, and being able to take that from him is huge.
Is it extra special to come back here just because you're back home?
Yeah, for sure. Not gonna lie, for some reason I was kind of like, you know, nervous to start the game, just being back home, get the nerves and whatever. But you know, I always love being back home. You know, for my friends and family, and you know. I think we've won pretty much most of the times when we're back home, so it's been good.
I think you're being aggressive early, just kind of made it a little bit harder on yourself for, you know,
yeah,
was it something
I don't know why.
Figured out,
yeah,
like, in the third or fourth?
I don't know why I spun three times, you know, I don't know why I tried to sham God in the second half. Like, there's certain things that's just like, why, you know, but, you know, it's not, progress isn't linear. You're not going to figure it all out, you know, in your third year, you're going to fall back into your old habits at times. And, you know, I think the biggest thing for me that stood out was that I was able to, you know, keep it simple when it counted, you know, and I think that's the biggest thing. You know, I don't know if I, you know, play the way I played down the stretch last year. You know, I don't know how. I think that's the part of growing that I think I'm trying to implement in my game.
Speaking of progress, how about Joe Ingles and his ability to shoot?
Joe, man, he loves. I don't know why teams keep giving him that three, you know, but he finds a way. You look at one possession, I think he, you know, went under a screen, over the screen, and back under a screen just to get to a spot. You know, he knows how to get to a spot. I respect him for that because, you know, no matter how teams play him, he always finds a way to get right there, and I try and implement that in my game, just watching it. And he also knows how to find guys, knows how to dictate the defense, you know, not let the defense dictate him.
Donovan, it's not like sure yet, but it's been rumored and possible that Zion's going to be playing against you guys on Thursday for his debut.
Wow. Good for him.
Could be a big deal, and are you trying to see it as much as
Honestly, you know, I think just looking at it in just regular game, you know, we understand last time we played there ended, you know, in a kind of crazy way. So they're going to come out ready to play. And the fact that he's playing, it'll be packed and it'll be huge and be a lot of coverage. But we're going to go out there and do our thing. You know, we're not going to make it too big of a deal. Let's go out there and just focus on the task at hand, you know. And I'm happy for him that he's finally getting ready to play. And, you know, he's healthy. You know, I think that's the biggest thing. We'll see what happens.
There's Donovan Mitchell. You heard him say it took him a little time to find his stuff, but boy, did he finish the game with a really nice night, 25 points, 4 assists. He did it on 8 of 19 shooting. Up next for the Utah Jazz, they'll take on the Pelicans in New Orleans coming up tomorrow night. That game will tip off at 6 o'clock. Pre-game coverage right here on 97.5 and 1280 The Zone begins at 5.
There's the best of the post-game show. When we come back, a little college football. PK and I with Tim Brando. Stay with us.
Take the Zone with you wherever you go.
Let's go.
Download the all-new Zone Sports Network app on your phone and get live streaming of The Zone as well as podcast editions of every show. From Salt Lake to Shanghai, Provo to Portugal, or Ogden to Oslo, wherever you go, we'll tag along.
Let's go.
Download the new Zone app by searching Zone Sports Network wherever you shop for apps. It's the Zone Sports Network app. From 97.5, 1280 The Zone and the Zone Sports Network.
DJ and PK, time to welcome in Tim Brando from Fox Sports. Play-by-play broadcaster. See him on a lot of big games across the Fox family of networks. He joins us now on the Sprint special guest line. Lease any phone and get an iPad or Samsung Tab A for $99.99. Visit the Sprint store nearest you. Tim, good morning.
David, good morning. Patrick, good to be with both of you. I have a little time here before I catch my flight to Indianapolis. We've got a great one on Wednesday night. With Butler and Seton Hall, number 5 versus number 18. So headed out there this afternoon.
It is college basketball season now that it's all over for college football. And for LSU, 15-0, they beat so many ranked teams. They beat so many top 10 teams. They beat all of the preseason top 4. It was an overwhelmingly fabulous season for them. You want to put them up there with any of the all-time teams? You just find that to be impossible.
Well, I think that we live in an era when that question is going to come up and you got to be prepared to respond to it. I do think that their accomplishment in the modern era of college football is, and when I say modern era, okay, I think you begin with the godforsaken BCS period and move forward, 1998 forward. And this is without question statistically, based on all the numbers that you just mentioned, beating the preseason AP top 4, never done. You know, a lot of teams have won national titles, but, you know, generally don't get to play, you know, the AP top 4 teams. But to some extent, because of the playoff and additional games now, the chances of playing at least two or three of the top four there. And in this case, because the SEC was a dominant league all season long, they do have the right to be able to say, hey, we did something even that Miami team in 2001 did not do. And that team was, I think, as loaded a team as you'll ever recall. 11 first-round draft picks were on that team back in 01, and they were dynamite. When you go you talk about the pantheon, though, the entire landscape of college football, and you bring in every generation, you know, we got a different conversation really to have. I don't think that there's any doubt that Joe Burrow had the best ever season in the history of the quarterback position in college football. And for him to be a member of the transfer portal and to have gone from 16 touchdown passes to 60 is a bit of a jolt that I don't think anyone has ever even contemplated happening in a college football season. So, and by the way, I will give you a hint. He's not done picking up hardware. He's got more hardware to come. Stay tuned for that. All of the college football awards for this year are not in, and I'm going to be able to see him and talk to him about his final one coming up this week. So, you know, I'm excited about the prospects of that. I'm going to go into Baton Rouge and see Joe on Wednesday after my game tomorrow night on FS1. So it's just remarkable what he's done. And Orgeron is you couldn't script a story in college football any better than this. I don't know that Spielberg could grab the character that would be the proper one to play Ed Orgeron, you know, and do what he's done as a homespun in-state guy that grew up where he did in South Lafourche Parish. And the school was too big for him to be a recruit, so he left after 2 weeks on campus and went back to La Rose, and his dad made him dig ditches and get back on the shrimp boat until Bobby Hebert called him and asked him to come to a smaller school, which is only about an hour from where I live in Shreveport in Natchitoches, Louisiana, to play at Northwestern State. So he was too small town a guy to even think he could go to school at LSU. Now he's the face of LSU, and he's a national championship coach that even most of the LSU fans didn't want 3 years ago. They would have far preferred Tom Herman or Jimbo Fisher. And now look. So pretty incredible story when you put it in that, you know, in that light.
You know, from a national perspective, Tim, is it a bad look that the Pac-12 loses Leach to the SEC?
I don't think so. I think it's another, you know, I think that's a big blanket. I think that's too broad a brush to paint with to some extent. It certainly doesn't help the Pac-12's image. But Pullman, you can make a case that Starkville is a bigger Pullman and that Starkville is a richer Pullman. And just as Pullman was to the Pac-12, what Texas Tech was to the Big 12. So this is to my way of thinking, a rather predictable move from Leach's point of view. Honestly, as a guy that covered the SEC for the lion's share of his four decades in this business, I never thought an SEC school would pull the trigger for Mike. I just didn't. I thought that he was he would not necessarily be an intellectual fit, B, the proper political fit, and C, maybe just a bit too on the edge in terms of his offensive philosophy for an SEC school or athletic director to feel comfortable with with the fan base that they have. But I don't think there's any question, looking at his response from the response that fans at Mississippi State gave him, that the decision John Cohen, the athletic director, made, and John has been around for quite some time, great baseball coach for a long period of time, just as Tanner was at South Carolina. he knew he had to make a big time hire because the last one he made didn't work out. You know, he needed someone that was going to stir the pot and to be the perfect counter for Lane Kiffin at Ole Miss. In so many ways, I think Mike has Ole Miss and Lane Kiffin to thank for Mississippi State being bold enough to go out and say, okay, Mike, bring your act here. We're ready for it. So I'm not going to say that this is a big loss for Washington State. I think it's an obvious great hire for Mississippi State. But for Washington State, I think that they probably knew this day was coming. It may surprise them that it came from the SEC, but I think they probably knew this day was coming.
Tim Brando joining us, Fox Sports play-by-play broadcaster, you know, from the Pac-12's perspective. Clay Helton stays at USC. A lot of people don't think that he can have a nationally significant season, even if he has a good one. Chris Peterson steps away at Washington. Oregon and Utah lose quarterbacks. Is there any reason to think that there'll be a big, bad, awesome team at the top of the Pac-12 or another year with a two-loss champion awaits?
Well, look, Oregon is legit. And I'm still not sure that even though that it didn't end the way anyone in Utah wanted it to end, and it certainly surprised me the manner in which it ended for Utah. And again, Oregon had a lot to do with that. I mean, they outplayed them in every sense of the word in the Pac-12 title game. But I still think the foundation and the program in general in Salt Lake is in great shape. I think plummeting all the way to the Alamo Bowl, as great a record as Kyle has in bowl games, that was a tough sell for he and his staff to get his team properly prepared to play. You know, everybody else that lost their conference championship game had a much nicer consolation prize than did Utah. And I think that showed up in the way they didn't show up in San Antonio. And allowed a Texas team that, in my opinion, was vulnerable to dominate them. So I think Utah can still be a factor, and I certainly think that even so much is made of the recruiting situation at USC, and I get to that to a certain extent because so much of what moves the needle with college football fans and alumni is recruiting based. But, I mean, Clay did have some impressive wins, including the one against Utah earlier in the year. I think the story at UCLA with USC next year will be somewhat compelling because in a lot of ways, even though you really didn't see it in the Utah game, UCLA is improving. Chip is now slowly kind of under the radar getting some of his guys in there. And they may be a little bit of a factor next year. So, look, the Pac-12 has a long way to go, but most of its issues are not related to the teams as much as they are related to the business. They are, when you start losing coaches because of the facilities factor and because of the financial factor, and I guess to your point about Mike Leach, should that be a concern, listen, it doesn't matter what school we're talking about. In the SEC, you're going to make north of $4 million, okay? Coach Orgeron, by the way, is one of the lower-paid coaches. I think he's $3.5 million for him. He'll certainly get a big bump. But he's also paying his coordinators, you know, respectively $2 million each, $2 million shared by the offense and over $2 million to Dave Aranda. The Pac-12 has got to find a way to fix its financial issues. And that falls flatly right at the doorstep of its commissioner, no doubt about it.
One of the things we heard from Cristobal and some others in the conference is there wasn't enough weight put on winning your conference when it comes to playoff consideration. A, do you agree with that? And B, can there be anything done about that?
Well, the governance in college football is still, it's in total disarray. Look when these games were played. I think most of the country, and look, the ratings are going to come out, and through the six or seven different platforms that ESPN trotted out there, and I thought they did a wonderful job blanketing their coverage last night and through the week. the games were still played after NFL playoff games, which dominated the news. And, you know, it's just they got to completely overhaul and restructure the format and not allow the calendar to dictate to them through NFL playoff games where they need to put their college football games. The fact that that game is on a Monday night this deep into January after another 16-day layoff between semifinal games is just absurd. So college football's got a lot of issues, despite the success of last night's game with two undefeated teams. And as I said, the ratings will come out and they'll be fine. But the narrative for college football has diminished. There's very little talk about college football nationally through the course of the week by comparison to what we had when we were moving away from the BCS and going to the playoffs. The lack of inclusion, the lack of stability and known factors. Mario Cristobal's point is well made, but it changes every year. The committee will use whatever contrived transparency they want to justify whatever decision they make. And this year, the winning your conference championship didn't mean as much. It just didn't. But we need to have those aspects, that subjectivity removed for, you know, some real, here's what you must do to qualify. And until we expand to eight teams, we're not going to get that. Well, people say, well, but I mean, we had three teams that were undefeated. Did we really get four? That's not the point. That's not the point. It's how we get to the best two teams. We had the best two teams playing last night. I don't think there's any question about that. Ohio State came back to differ, but they lost, and they had a 16-0 lead and lost to Clemson. So, you know, I've got no qualm with who we had playing. I do have issues with how we got there. And we need more definiteness as part of the criteria, not all of these different aspects within these nebulous thoughts that are put on paper that the committee can use whenever they want to justify whatever decision they make when it's all so very subjective. That's got to be taken care of. College football is the most mismanaged sport of all sports in our country today. It is still a five-conference cartel. It will conveniently take care of its brand names, and it has allowed the media, the mainstream media, to just dismiss it and say, we only have to worry about four or five teams every year. As good as LSU and Clemson are, again, two teams from the same part of the country, the Sun Belt region of our country. And there is a complete disconnect for the West Coast and the East Coast when we have this. And I've got no problem with the championship coming down to the same two teams. I just want those teams that from other parts of the country, be it the Pac-12 or the Big Ten or anywhere in the along the Eastern Seaboard. I want them all to have an opportunity. And we need to move in that direction. I think we will. But, you know, we're going to need, you know, someone that's really strong, that's in a position of power. Someone like a Jim Delaney, maybe, now that he's no longer Big Ten commissioner, to step in and have a voice and say, fellas, listen, reasonable minds can agree that we've got to do something to improve the narrative for our sport because we are losing ground in terms of its daily importance to the fabric of sports in our country.
Tim, as always, we appreciate having you and all your opinions on. Thanks for coming on and enjoy the big college basketball game.
You bet, fellas. All the best to you. Talk to you later.
There's PK and I with Fox Sports' Tim Brando. When we come back, what is trending? All the headlines next.